You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 2 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fellow fiends, welcome to another terrifying and delectable episode of Nightmare on Film Street, the horror podcast with zero credibility, but all of the blood, ghouls, and gore your puny heart can handle. Let's give a grave welcome to our hosts, John and Kim.
Hello again, fiends, and welcome to another episode of Nightmare on Film Street. I feel like I say that differently usually. I'm John.
I'm Kim.
And this week we are talking Bed and Bunker. That didn't make sense.
No, it did.
Nope.
It was good.
Okay. Well, this week we are talking captive movies. This is also not making sense. Have you guys ever been locked, chained to a bed, or trapped inside a bunker instead of getting...
Don't all stand up.
You're on Airbnb, you're looking for a bed and breakfast, you're not really paying attention to the listing, and the next thing you know, you've got 1,800 free nights because you're not allowed to leave. It sounds like a good deal at the time, but then you realize everyone who you love doesn't know you're gonna die underground at the hands of a mad woman?
Whoa. That went some confusing places.
Which, of course, is to say we are talking about Rob Reiner's Misery and Dan Trachtenberg's 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Two very different, but altogether similar, captor movies.
In an episode we're calling Bed and Bunker.
Good job, John. Brought it round. Pretty similar premises. You have isolation, you have a not altogether sane villain, and some interesting side elements. We got perhaps a hammer. Perhaps some aliens.
Well, you know what? You know what I just realized saves both of our main characters in each of these movies?
Freedom.
Creativity.
Oh.
Art. Expression.
Resourcefulness, I would say.
I think it's all resourcefulness yeah. And just cunning. Before we get into it, though, Kim, what is keeping you creepy this week?
Well, Us came out just this past weekend, so I don't know if you saw it on the weekend. Judging by those box office numbers, you probably did.
I'm getting kind of annoyed of saying Jordan Peele's Us. Because it's like, hey, have you seen Us recently? Or did you see Us this weekend? You're like, no, we haven't hung out in months. Like, no, the movie Us.
It's a hard title. It's a really hard title
to
describe. Yeah, that might be it.
Right?
Yeah, Us. Like, that's not a title for a film, a title for anything. Except for the movie that we're about to talk about, Us.
I'll go first. I didn't love it as much as I thought I would.
Yeah, I need to see it again. I'm still kind of stewing on it. I think everybody had really high expectations for this one, and there were a lot of emotions and kind of like wanting something out of it and what we were going to expect from it. And I was kind of just a little not wowed. It's got some really great performances and some really characters, and I love everybody involved, the duality of the roles that they're playing. It's really fun to watch. It's really interesting to see them get into the two different characters that they all have to play, which I loved. But the story didn't engage me as much as I was expecting, and the trailer was really well cut, really selling this as a traditional horror film. And I found the trailer very genuinely scary. So I was expecting the film in turn to be more traditional horror and very scary.
Hmm.
Also, Jordan Peele himself has said that this is more of a straight horror film than Get Out was. And I always found Get Out to be
a horror film. Yeah.
Exactly. So I was expecting a lot different than... I didn't find this movie scary.
Yeah.
And normally I don't say that about horror films. I'm normally not on the camp that horror needs to be scary. But I was really anticipating something spooky out of the Us characters. And they delivered all of their trailer moments, but not much else for me.
Yeah. Especially given the, like, how creepy they look.
Mm-hmm.
I was really expecting this movie to get under my skin more and just, like, make me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And, like, it did, sure, it did in a few moments, but not nearly as much as it promised. And, like, that's fine, whatever, cool. It is very effective for a lot of other people. I am seeing no shortage of people saying it's the scariest movie they've ever seen. And that's great. That's awesome. That means more people are going to go check it out in the theater, and I'm happy for that. But, supernatural stories are definitely really good for telling other stories. Like, it is a great way to build a metaphor. I didn't love it so much in this one. And I really wanted to like this movie, is my big problem. I want that whole third act to be another movie. I don't know that I really wanted to know what was going on with those characters. And when I got it, I felt like I should have got it a lot earlier. It's really hard. I'm trying to, like, obviously we don't want to spoil anything because there's a pretty good chance you haven't seen it yet. But it's definitely worth checking out. I'm also looking forward to seeing it again. You know, maybe now that the hype is gone and we can just sort of watch it without any sort of expectations. Maybe it's building a better story than we know. Like, mm-hmm. maybe it really needs a second watch to sink in.
Yeah, and there is something to be said, too, about movies that make film fans and genre fans talk and discuss things.
Totally.
And I can always appreciate that about a film when they leave you with themes and ideas to chew on and what this means and what that means. So this film definitely has a lot of that. There is a lot under the surface. And whether or not I agree that it was done the most, like, seamless or eloquent way, there's still so much about this movie that I haven't quite figured out. And that is great. That's
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
If you do want to chat about the film, more spoilery, and you're looking for somebody to talk to about it, we do have a spoiler thread going in the Facebook Fiends group. That's at facebook.com/groups/horrorfiendsofnofs. You can get as spoiler as you want there. And if you want to know John and my uncensored opinions and hear us really get into the different plot points of the movie and such, we did a full Patreon exclusive episode that dropped just last weekend. So that's at patreon.com/nightmareonfilmstreet.
Speaking of Patreon, before we get started, I want to give a big shout out to our most recent supporters: Catherine, Mike, Rebecca, Katie, Alexandra, Ryan, Jillian, and Stephanie. Oh, and Alexa, which is going to be great for some people, I'm sure. Guys, look around you. We're all trapped in a bunker. There are plenty of...
Oh, because it's like if people are listening on their bot things.
There's plenty of room for all of us. I'm glad you're all here. And we're going to make it out okay. Whether or not there's actually anything outside to be worried about, who knows? But is it really worth walking up all those stairs? There's a lot of stairs. you could just sit down. We got a whole fucking jukebox down here.
Puzzles?
Not a sledgehammer in sight.
Thank you so much for supporting us on Patreon. You're going to get today's bonus episode. We're playing a fun little game in tandem with captors and captees and captives and captots. And there's hours and hours of bonus content there for you if you have not checked it out at patreon.com/nightmareonfilmstreet.
That's enough chit-chat. Let's get into the movies. Let's talk 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Children behave, that's what they say when we're together. And watch how you play, they don't understand. And so we're running just as fast as we can, holding on to one another.
not open that door, they're going to get all of us killed.
Something's coming.
Directed by Dan Trachtenberg. I probably said that name wrong. 10 Cloverfield Lane is currently sitting at a 7.2 out of 10 on IMDb and 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, 3 out of 4 from RogerEbert.com, and 3.6 out of 5 on Letterboxd. Also has the greatest horror movie trailer ever made.
It is so good. It is the best horror movie trailer.
Yeah.
The music and the cutting and John Goodman dancing at the record
player. The jukebox.
So good.
I watch that trailer occasionally. I can't say I watch that movie all the time. Like, I don't put it on every weekend. Like every Sunday morning with my coffee, like memories. But yeah, occasionally when I feel like listening to "I Think We're Alone Now" by Brand. No. Oh, what's the name?
Isn't it Tiffany?
Tiffany. There we go.
The version in the movie isn't Tiffany.
It's
though.
Like that original whatever's version. I don't know. It's like a doo-wop-y era. It's probably the somethings.
Sure.
There was like a template for making your band name, and if it wasn't just like you and the...
Like Jimmy and the...
Yeah, it was just the somethings. And nothing's really changed. But when I feel like listening to that song, I will occasionally just put on the trailer for this movie. And then I'm like kind of bummed that there isn't like a creepy remix version that I can listen to, like a 2.5 minute version where like it really winds down into something sinister.
I remember being so happy in the theater when it was in the movie because the trailer with the song had got us so pumped.
Yeah.
And then when it was actually in the film, it was just like, yes.
We're here. This is what we came for. Don't even wait for the end credits. Just walk right out.
So full disclosure, this film was actually my number one pick for 2016. It was my favorite horror film of 2016. I don't remember where you had it. Because I think
it was on the list.
Do you remember what your ranking was?
Nope. I don't really remember much of that list at all.
Oh, well, Train to Busan, I think, was your number
one. Oh, right.
Yeah.
That was a good year.
Mm-hmm. I only remember because I make fun of you for saying that you don't like zombie films, and then every year you put zombie films on your top 10 list.
Like right in the top, right? Train to Busan, One Cut of the Dead, Overlord, always.
Yep.
Because hey, that, honestly, if I can find a zombie movie that surprises me that I like, it kind of immediately gets a bump.
That's true.
And
that's
there have been some really good zombie movies lately. 10 Cloverfield Lane, not one of them. You know what? I don't even know if it appeared. Was it? I think if it was on my list, I don't think it was very high. Because like that first time that I saw this, I didn't love the end of it. I don't really know why.
Yeah, I don't know why either. Yeah. You know, that is the most common complaint though I hear when, you know, I'm raving about this movie on the internet and people are like, well, the ending, it feels, you know, this wasn't originally a Cloverfield movie. And I'm just like fingers in my ears and dance on by.
Who cares what movie it wasn't? Talk about the movie that it is.
Every story had a first draft.
Right. Exactly.
Although I would argue that transition did not necessarily work out for God Particle. But that isn't the film that we are speaking about today. So let's talk Cloverfield Lane.
I'm kind of a sucker for great title sequences and title cards. This movie's got one of the best ones. And it's so simple. There's nothing to it. But Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Michelle, is packing up her house. She's clearly leaving her fiancé. She's left a ring on the table. She's grabbed the few essentials, including a bottle of scotch. And she's out the fucking door. But she gets run off the road. And as her car is careening and the camera is inside with her and it's just chaos and we're flipping around, and it's just like cuts to silence and the black screen. It's like Bad Robot Presents. And then like back to more chaos and then 10 Cloverfield, or just Cloverfield is what it says. Just says Cloverfield. And then the L's slowly extend to 10 Cloverfield Lane. Oh, man.
Yeah, and that's the exact same design that they used for the poster. Do you remember? The poster was really good.
Poster's insane where you have this like gigantic long
line.
Tunnel.
Yeah.
Well, it's like an elevator shaft down to a bunker in the basement.
And some really cool shots with that later in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So Michelle wakes up. She is chained to a pipe on a cement floor with a tiny flat mattress. And she realizes she is now the captive of John Goodman's character.
In case you were curious what the theme of this episode was.
We're going to say captor and captive a lot.
We're going to say it like it's bolded. Yeah.
John Goodman's character Howard, who is this socially strange, very uptight, rigid, controlled, silly person. Is the best. How else could you describe him?
The guy's definitely got some sort of obsessive
control issues.
Yeah, some obsessive compulsive disorder. Like he doesn't like people touching. I don't think it's necessarily like a possessive thing. I don't think it's that he doesn't want Emmett, the other person.
Oh, I think it's a possessive thing.
Oh, I think that's part of it.
I think it's a possessive thing.
See, well, like, that's what I think is really good about this movie. Like, John Goodman especially, like, a lot of the quirks of the characters really sort of help underline their wants.
Mm-hmm. I think this movie, had we have not gone with the captor-captive theme, we could have paired it with Creep. Patrick Bryce and Mark Duplass's film.
It's a good one.
Because of that borderline unsettling feeling you get with Harold's character. Because scene to scene and moment to moment and line of dialogue to line of dialogue, it could go either fucking way.
That's a really good point.
You know what I mean? There's just an unsettling air around him that this film isn't subtle like the Creep films, but it nails that unease and the things that you can pick up in human nature, like with human connection and human interaction.
Yeah. Yeah, he is such a strange character because... Well, what's interesting, too, is that they are trapped in a bunker. And, you know, if they were just in an apartment or a house, like, everything about how this guy acts, what he says, how he operates, screams, get the fuck out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But you literally can't. Like,
but there's moments in the film where you feel like you misunderstood him. And
oh, yeah.
You feel guilty, like Mary Elizabeth
Winstead's
character.
Maybe he's just got,
character.
Asperger's, right? And he's just not good at
or
this
he's just
stuff.
A quirky dude. Yeah. But and he doesn't know how to convey things in a socially accepted way. And you feel guilty for assuming all these terrible things about him when he's actually just this simple, decent human being.
Yeah. Like, the way he talks is crazy unless the end of the world has happened. And it's not like he's going to change how he speaks or how he interacts with people once the world has ended. So at some point you have to understand whether or not, like, maybe he's actually, out of the goodness of his heart, trying to save some people as he's going down into his bunker.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's just fucking nuts, right?
So I don't know if it's come up much on the podcast, because I don't know if we've done a lot of John Goodman films, but he is definitely...
Is this the first one?
I don't know. We haven't done... we have to do Red State one time, because I think that's dark enough to...
We could.
Yeah. We could do, like, Comedians Turned Horror or something.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Or we could just do, like, the dark films of Kevin Smith.
Gotta do Arachnophobia at some point.
Oh, yeah.
John Goodman's in that.
That's true. But what I was going to say is John Goodman is definitely one of my favorite actors of all time.
Right.
He is so good in everything that he's in.
It's crazy that this guy hasn't been nominated for an Oscar.
It is crazy.
That's insane. And he got nominated, I think he won, right? A Golden Globe for Argo? I don't know why he didn't get nominated in the Academy Awards. Just saying, guys. Argo wasn't a bad movie.
He has to have been nominated.
My cursory look on IMDb, I saw nothing.
Ugh.
Yeah. He is, he's one of the greatest actors of all time. It's a shame that he doesn't get, like, leading man roles, but there has never been a movie that says, and also starring John Goodman, that I haven't said, I'm watching that movie tonight. Guy's amazing in everything he's in. That said, though, and this is true about a lot of captor movies, in fact, both movies that we are talking about today, I don't understand why either of these people think that when they wake up from being unconscious after a car accident, after any accident, and they're stuck in an unfamiliar place, that they're just gonna willfully take pills from you. Like, here, take these, it'll make you feel better. Like, no, thank you! Sorry! And then they're so, oh, little gratitude would be nice. Like, I have no fucking idea who you are, where I am. Like, I have no memory of you rescuing me, so I can't say thank you so much, sir.
I get what you're saying. I would be hesitant, but you
would you take those pills?
In the sense of misery, I would have.
Okay,
in 10 Cloverfield Lane, I probably would not have.
Yeah.
But it depends on how much pain you're in. If you're in, like, level 10 frowny face pointing at the doctor's office pain, you might take anything anybody gives you. I would have eaten his ice cream. I would have taken that ice cream.
Not at that moment.
I might have.
Wow, this has been a rough day, guys.
I'm so sad.
I think I need this, yeah. I do like it in a bowl.
I want the cone, too.
I want them both.
So let's talk about some of the plot of this movie, because we are just talking about John Goodman being a creep. A wonderful creep.
Oh, man, he's such a good creep in this movie. Like, the best creep there is. Okay, so yeah, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Michelle, wakes up in a bunker. Howard explains to her that she was in an accident, that he's rescued her, and that there is somebody else in the bunker as well whose name is Emmett. The three of them, as far as they know, are three of some of the only survivors left in what was an apocalyptic attack. Don't know if it's chemical, don't know if it's nuclear. All we know is that the bunker is safe and the air outside is poison.
Yeah. And of course, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, I don't know why we have to keep saying her full name.
Right. Could just say Michelle.
Unfortunately, Michelle is, well, you know, it makes sense. She is rightfully so kind of questioning this strange and quirky man that's holding her hostage. And so he allows her to go up to the entrance of the bunker to take a look at, like, Frank and Mildred or
Fran and somebody, right?
Yeah, his resident pigs who died by mysterious air poisoning. And we see, and so does Michelle, that they are definitely dead and rotting.
Yeah.
And so back down to the bunker we go.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily take that as evidence.
I would have. I would have been like, fuck.
I mean, he could have just as easily.
Yeah, but I think Emmett, too, adds some credibility to his story.
Emmett really does. Because he also says that he saw it.
And he helped build it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He did help build the
bunker.
Like,
he helps vouch for Harold in a way. Like, oh, Harold just is who he is. He's always been like that.
Howard.
Howard is how he is. He's always
just call him
like
Howie.
He's always been like that. And he adds some sort of like, oh, this is just how this man has always been. He's not this like crazy recluse. There's neighborhood people who know of him.
Yeah. They just don't happen to know about the bunker. And because I helped build it, I knew that this was the one safe place that there would be in the event of this attack.
Mm-hmm.
He describes it as seeing a gigantic red flash, like of biblical proportions, unlike anything he's ever seen. And he just immediately rushed over to Howard's place. The only question I have, because later we're told that Howard admits that he is the one who ran Michelle off the road, which I think we all figure that out anyway. But it was an accident because the attack had happened. He was trying to get back to his bunker. He was frantic. He wasn't paying attention. But, you know, because he knew that this was his fault, he stopped to help her out. Bring her to the bunker so she's safe and everything. How come she didn't see the flash? Because the flash that Emmett is talking about was the attack. So I'm just saying there's some timeline issues there. Do you think what he's saying is actually true? Or do you think he saw her at the gas station at the beginning of the movie and was like, I'm gonna take her to my bunker?
Yeah. And then the attack happened at some point.
Convenient!
Either after her car was off the road or what have you.
Yeah, timeline-wise, it was probably like, run this girl off the road because I want her. And then as he's getting her out of her car and up to the truck, bang, flash goes off. Like, oh my god, we've got bigger things to deal with. But at least I've got a really good excuse of why I can keep her down. Like, the lies that I've fed every other girl that I've kidnapped is now actually going to be true. Unfortunately, Emmett forces his way in and he's stuck with somebody else.
It's kind of ruined his plans.
Yeah. But that does lead me to like a big thing that I wrote down in my notebook here. It's the chicken or the egg thing. Do you think he built the bunker because of the paranoia and it just so happens to be a nice place that he can bring girls that he wants to kidnap? Or do you think he always wanted to kidnap girls and that's what fed into this quote-unquote paranoia of the end time, so I need a bunker?
How I always pictured Howard's story is that, so Emmett confirms that he does have a wife and daughter and that they live in Chicago or whatever, like they've left him.
But that could just be what
now,
he's told.
Now, I know, I'm just telling you how I experienced the film.
Okay.
So I believe that his wife and daughter left him and that in his loneliness or whatever that spawned from that, he kidnapped that local girl and started calling her Megan. But there's definitely some weird sexual stuff with it. So I think he's trying to replace like a lack of familial love. So I think the bunker was like a convenient, like, oh, I can just keep her here and make her my family.
Oh, you know what? It's because this girl can be the daughter I care for. And when I need it, the wife.
Ew.
In one girl.
Ew.
Easier to control one girl than two.
Why did you have a revelation with that? I was just like, let's not go there.
Well, I mean, I was also thinking about the board game scene where they're playing, I think, Password is what it is.
Yes.
That is the greatest scene in the whole fucking movie.
Well, it's
for two reasons.
Service level, yeah, because they're up to no good, and we think that that Howard has found out what's going on, but also too because he doesn't know the word, like the word woman doesn't come to him. Well, because that's how he's categorized Michelle's character.
Yeah, he does not see her as anything other than a little princess, a girl. Like that's all the only words that come to mind for him. He cannot conceive of her as a woman. That is a nut scene.
Which is crazy because she is the most resourceful, MacGyvering Nancy Drew that ever walked inside a bunker.
Right? From moment one, she does not stop trying to escape. I mean, like, there's maybe a little bit in the middle where she realizes that maybe there's something to what Howard is saying, but she does not stop. Her character is, do not wait around, waiting is pointless. And I think they even exemplify that in the beginning when she whittles down her crutch to a point. She's going to stab Howard, but she gets bored of standing around and waiting for him to come in. So she puts some of her clothes in the vent, lights it on fire so the smoke detector will go off, and then he'll come in. Like, she's constantly trying to speed up how fast she can get out of that bunker. There is, no matter how dark it gets in there, or how grim, or how dangerous it is to do what she's doing, she does not stop trying to escape.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, first time watching this, it's really rewarding seeing all of those scenes because everything that's presented in this film, every tool that the camera looks at or every object that the camera looks at becomes part of the plot in almost like an M. Night Shyamalan way.
Yeah.
It's all tools for Michelle to use to ultimately survive, one, being held captive, and two, the Cloverfield part of the story.
Yeah, so,
But I do want to criticize the film in that sense that although it is rewarding on like a entertaining movie watching level, I think the perfect seamless way everything rounds up in a nice little bow at the end makes this a little less than perfect because the film is too pristine.
Okay. Like it's
unrealistic.
Everything
I understand we're talking about a movie with aliens and a captive who's holding people in a bunker. Like, I know that in itself is not a realistic premise, but they did a really great job of taking this sensational story about insane, improbable events, and they made really well-rounded characters, but it's almost too perfectly set up. Like, you know, a video game, the olden time video games, when you would walk into a room and you knew all the items you could interact
with.
Because
they would glow a little.
They had a different amount of, like, pixelization. Or, like, when you're watching Scooby-Doo or Bugs Bunny and how you knew what was backdrop and what was going to be interacted with in the scene because the backdrop was really painterly and everything else was just comic-colored or just, like, one-tone color. This movie's like that. Like, the girl that Howard happened to have kidnapped was also wearing the earrings that she was wearing when she was kidnapped and attacked in the bunker to leave the same earring that was in the photograph. And she wrote "Help me," and her hand was bleeding at the time that she wrote it. And there's blood on the earring. And
she had the bottle
of alcohol in the back of the truck, which happens to be able to make a Molotov cocktail when she has no other means.
I love that.
Everything, I know, but it's great and it's fun upon first and second watch as a moviegoer. It's super entertaining in that shoot 'em up kind of way.
Yeah.
But when you're watching it a third or a fourth time, you're just like, oh, this is just a little too perfect.
I think it makes for a tight script.
It's a very tight script, and I'm saying it's good, and it's good on a first watch, but it takes it away from being realistic. Everything just happens to work out for this character in these really profound ways that she would have died.
But it's because, I'm not going to try
what to defend what you're saying. What if that Molotov cocktail didn't make it in that thing's mouth? Like, game over. Game fucking over.
Hey, I mean, a lot of people would have said game fucking over whether or not they knew that cocktail was in the backseat anyway, right? Like, she was just like, I gotta fucking try, because why the fuck not? And you're right. Yeah, sure. Like, against all odds, she got out. But I mean...
But it's against all odds. Against all odds. Against all odds. Against all odds.
Yeah, I thought one of the things you were gonna complain about was the, was it like the CO2 canister that he uses to freeze the alcohol for disinfecting that she also uses later to break a lock after he's told her, like, oh, back when I was in the Navy, we, you know, if the CO was being a jerk, we used to freeze the lock while he was in the bathroom door and break it off. I thought that was great because she remembers that story. It's just a fun little anecdote in a scene where you're realizing that, you know, maybe Howard's not as bad as we think he is, but she uses that and retains it and keeps it for later on when she needs to escape.
Mm-hmm.
Also, that escape, I think, is a point positive that his plan was always to build the bunker to kidnap girls. Because
he just has the acid on hand.
Well, it's not that he has. Oh, that acid, right? We'll get back to that. No, where she freezes the lock, breaks the lock, and that's the escape hatch that she's able to get out of. It is not. It's nothing like the airtight seal that he has at the opening.
Mm.
Like there is nothing about that little hatch that says, "Oh, this is going to keep out all airborne pathogens."
Like, it doesn't have a double wall or anything.
Yeah, it doesn't have anything. Like, I understand that it's essentially where the air filtration system is. So, I mean, like, we need fresh air to be pulled in. But it's definitely not the kind of setup you would expect to see for somebody who is going, like, the whole nine yards on making an absolute, like, nuclear bomb-safe bunker.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah. I think the acid is a good giveaway.
Yeah,
the tub of acid.
The acid is a pretty good giveaway that you are planning on killing people and hiding them. Because why does he need it?
Well, and he was initially going into that bunker alone. Emmett wasn't supposed to be there.
That's what he says.
Yeah.
She was going to wind up in that bucket of acid.
In the bucket of acid?
Oh, yeah. Don't you think that's how he got rid of Megan?
Yeah. But I think... So the problem is we don't really necessarily know his MO because he doesn't fully get revealed to us, like, the dark side of him. It's all insinuated from, like, that photo. And how Megan could have died is maybe she almost escaped or something. Like, she did something where she died as an accident and she attacked him and he was defending himself. And because I just don't see him killing her. I don't see him killing... Michelle either. Like, I see him as getting slashed and throwing her in timeout before before killing back.
Yeah, but Megan exists in a world where there was no apocalypse, and she doesn't exist now. She just disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to her. So, no matter what.
We don't know.
He has killed her.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Yeah.
I just don't think we know how that all went down. I see him as wanting to keep a companion.
Hmm. Do you think he used the end of the world line on Megan? Like, do you think he was like, I saved you, it's okay, end of the world, we can't go out there.
I'm just going to leave my bunker for a little bit.
Well, I think he just never left the bunker.
Oh.
Like, let's say he's not independently wealthy, but let's say he owns his own house, he's got a bank account set up for his property taxes and whatnot throughout the year. Maybe he's got an accountant that handles that. But, you know, if you own everything, like you've paid off everything that you own, and you have enough food for however many years, you don't need to leave the bunker. You don't need to leave the bunker.
Yeah, I didn't think of that.
So I would imagine he's done that with Megan. Or alternatively, he would leave for work and come home and Megan would still be locked in the bunker.
That's interesting. We'll have to corner the screenwriters if we ever meet them.
It could even be that...
tell me about Megan.
Yeah, tell me. What happened to Megan? We want answers. We're like TMZ reporters cornering them in the fucking doorway. No, like, I wonder if, like, you hear about, like, Howie Mandel. Howie Mandel's got a problem with germs. And apparently he has, I've heard, has a guest house that if he has... like a cycle that he's going into where he just needs to, like, be alone. He goes over there and then, like, debriefs himself, comes back. This could be 100% fake, but I could imagine a world where somebody is in the depths of a vicious cycle where I need to, like, Howard Hughes needs to lock himself away in just a movie theater, away from everybody until he recuperates and is okay with the idea that germs exist and he can go back out in the real world. Maybe that's something that Howard needs to do. Maybe he gets too conspiracy minded and just like the chemtrails, I gotta go underground for a month or two, and he just takes a girl with him when he goes.
That's really creepy.
Oh, what he's doing here isn't?
Yeah,
come on. He kills Emmett and then gets dressed up and has a clean shave and like, don't worry,
that's
now
so
that he's
creepy.
Gone, we can do whatever we want now.
Yeah, that's so creepy after that happens. So after he shoots Emmett, which is a huge surprise, it comes because Michelle and Emmett have decided that they are going to escape. This is after they found the earring and determined that Howard has killed this girl, Megan, who he's been saying is his daughter all along.
Well, also because she shows the photo to Emmett, and Emmett's like, nah, that girl's name isn't Megan. That
exactly.
Girl's name is, like, Louise. I went to high school with her. She disappeared.
So Michelle has been fashioning a gas mask and biohazard suit out of an old shower curtain, and they've been doing it on the down low, but Howard finds out, and when he confronts them with a big giant vat of acid, Emmett ends up in it.
Oh yeah.
And he cleans up and he cleans himself up and he's clean shaven. He's wearing a collared shirt and it's just like, finally things are as they're supposed to be. And he's so chipper.
Yeah, I'll go make dinner. You have your ice cream. Like, I am not in the mood to do anything but scream right now.
Ugh. That bus ticket.
Right? Ugh. That folded up bus ticket. Like, you can tell it's been opened. Like,
I almost cried in the theater when we first saw this.
Right.
I was like, you can't cry in a sci-fi horror film, you fucking loser.
It's a human story, Kim. It just happens to have some sci-fi horror elements around it.
It had so many folds.
So many folds. Mm. He's definitely taken it out. Like,
I know, I looked at
it. And looked at it, right? Like, every day, this could have been me. Why didn't I do this? Anyway, speaking of seeing it in the theater, I think this was the first movie we saw in, like, Ultra AVX. And
I don't even know what that means.
Ultra Audiovisual Experience, I think?
Woo.
Audiovisual Experience? That's gotta be it. Either way, big screen. Big sound, and
big popcorn.
Could not have been a better movie to big popcorn. Okay, it was a great movie to see in Ultra AVX because you would maybe expect to see a superhero movie in that kind of setting. I think it's usually what they're used for, superhero movies, action movies, but
big budgets.
The calculated use of sound in this movie is so fucking impressive.
Like, for instance, when the knife goes through that vent the first time, man. When Michelle's trying to do her final big getaway, she's got the suit on, she's going through the vent because she knows the backup hatch, and she's...
Every single one of those knife plunges was like an explosion.
Oh,
in the movie
so
theater.
Loud.
And that gun when he shoots Emmett, too. Yeah.
Ugh.
And he's screaming the whole time, like, because his face is like melted off. Oh, man. Just stay with me.
And there's like, so much skin dangling off his hand. The determination with the level of, he's at a 10 level of frowny face pain. That level of determination is the scariest thing. Just when, if I had a really bad paper cut, I don't think I could chase anybody down. I'd be like, But his arm is a goop of skin.
Well, I think he wants her to die with him, right? Like, that's more than
explode with me.
Explode. But yeah, the gunshot, all of it, all of those sequences, because the majority of the movie is fairly quiet. We're in a bunker. And most of the sounds that we hear are...
And I think we're alone now.
And I think we're alone now, so it's nice and quiet. There doesn't seem to be anyone around.
One around.
Yeah. Something about... It, something of sound. Yeah, it really popped in the Ultra AVX theater. And... Which, I mean, is like part of a bigger conversation about the sound design in this movie. And I think sound is really how we show perspective in the movie as well. The audio that we hear is almost always from Megan's ears. Because especially after that gunshot sequence, I think we've seen that in movies enough to expect it, but your ears are ringing and we are Michelle at this point and we can barely hear Howard talking to her, trying to tell her like, it's okay. He was going to hurt us, but like sound slowly comes back into it. We also see it earlier in the movie too. When she's first trying to escape, after she like bashes that bottle on Howard's face and she's finally made her way up to the padlock, and just before she gets out, there's a woman there and that woman is screaming at her and it's all super muffled, but it like becomes clearer and clearer and more into focus as Megan's adrenaline is starting to drop. Because the sound starts to suck out as we see Howard going for his keys to open the bottle, where he realizes that, you know, she has them in her hand. But it helps, like, get us into her character. So, like, it's her journey, it's her story, it's who we're with.
Mm-hmm. I think, especially what you're saying with the, when we first see the woman at the door, it helps make where they are feel more like a tomb. Like, you can feel the thickness of the walls with how muffled it is at first. And you're right, the sound of it moving and changing is, like, the rush of adrenaline.
Yeah.
Which is so crazy to point out that can be achieved just through sound alone.
Yeah.
Because... I don't know if I noticed that consciously, but now that you're saying it, I can literally hear it in my mind's ear.
Yeah. No, that's okay. And at the end of the movie, too, when she's escaping, she's put on her, like, her makeshift MacGyver hazmat suit, and we don't think it's weird or strange so much because, like, she needs it to survive, you know, just in case. And when we get out, most of the audio, it's, like, inside her helmet.
And
it's
the camera is inside the helmet.
Yeah, it's right. Yeah, yeah. Like, we're right claustrophobic.
And you can hear, like,
there.
The... That was gross. Yeah. Why did we do that?
I'm sorry, everybody. But yeah, like, we're panicked, we're frantic, and then as she starts to realize that it's just a regular, normal day, she takes her helmet off and we can hear bird sounds.
Yeah, and then bugs and stuff.
Yeah, and it's like, it's less panicked. And then all of a sudden we cut out to a wider shot and we see her in her whole suit and she looks like a crazy person. And like, and we're with her in that moment because that's her realization. I just love the
sound. And
then
10 seconds later, it's like, no, there's aliens.
Oh, yeah, by the way, there are aliens. And then they drop something in the fucking corn. Get out of here.
And it's got a sucker face.
It does. It's got a weird ass sucker face.
It's like a sucker face bear dog.
It hates car alarms.
And humanity in general. So let's talk about this, because I've talked about this with a few people on Twitter before.
Okay.
That the monsters from Cloverfield, uh-huh, the original film, and the monsters from 10 Cloverfield Lane, mm-hmm, are not of the same species / planet / whatever. Especially now after God Particle, the theory is that they are of different timelines.
Okay, but I mean, in God Particle, the only real monster we see is the Clover variant. if anything, Cloverfield Paradox is more tied to Cloverfield than 10 Cloverfield Lane is. So yeah, like, okay, so are there different species? Maybe.
And a lot of the complaints, too, were that in this one, we actually get a spaceship and we see some biochemical warfare. Mm-hmm. And people were really mad because the original Clover is more like a giant monster movie. It's not an intelligent species movie. It's not about an alien invasion. We kind of understand or gather that Clover is not an earthling.
Yeah.
Especially if you watch that Ferris wheel scene.
Okay. Well, here, let's go back to the Ferris wheel scene for a second, because the other...
Oh, we're getting some Cloverspiracies up in
the
here.
The other school of thought here, and I mean to take you to college on this one, but we're going back Cloverfield 101. That Ferris wheel scene, I think there's a different way to look at it.
Okay.
We are not seeing the Clover monster fall into the water. We are seeing a satellite that has been knocked out of orbit and fallen back to Earth. That once it hits the water and it sinks, it disturbs the Clover monster. That's one school of thought.
Where do you get that from?
The internet.
Why is it a satellite? Why couldn't it be an egg?
Well, apparently it has something to do with the Japanese company that Rob from Cloverfield is going to work for, who has some dealings in
this
everything.
Is a found footage movie, John.
Yeah, but there's a story behind the story, Kim. Okay. I've heard that theory online. Now, here is my hope. I think it ties into what you're saying here about 10 Cloverfield Lane and my desires for the next Cloverfield movie. Or, honestly, Cloverfield 8. I don't even give a shit. This is such a wild idea. I do not think it could be the next movie. But because of the instances with Cloverfield Paradox and 10 Cloverfield Lane, let's assume aliens have come to Earth. They are here to conquer, and it's because of the God Particle. Like, that's part of it. That was what caused it, and that's why the aliens are here, because now we're in some weird other universe, and they're coming for our natural resources, right?
Okay.
Now, Clover, separate monster, has been awoken, is currently terrorizing the city when the aliens attack, and Clover is now like Godzilla. He's our protector, and he's going to tear these aliens down and save humanity, and at the end, he's probably going to die. We're going to be like, oh no, he was our pet.
Oh my God.
And he'll be like, I just wanted to love you.
Okay, so I love that.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah.
I agree.
That'd be great.
That's great.
It's a little wild, though.
No, I fucking
directed
love it.
By the guys that did Crank. That's how I'd see that movie.
Well, what would it be? It can't be like Godzilla versus Mothra. What would it be, like Cloverfield versus Cloverfield?
Cloverfield versus Martians.
Cloverfield versus the Martians?
Yeah.
I like it.
Cloverfield Saves Christmas.
Okay. These are good.
These are all good.
Yep.
Yep.
So that's a great theory. It's probably not true, but I would totally watch that. I think that would save Cloverfield the franchise.
Can you imagine?
But my belief, and this is what I'd always argued, is that Clover is definitely part of the same alien species that these monsters and their weird spaceship are part of in 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument is that if, say, humanity went to another planet and, mm-hmm, you know, we were just going to, like, fuck shit up, and we had these giant-ass hippos that we had... You know, we don't want to send humans there. We don't want to waste perfectly intelligent brains.
Yeah.
So we'll drop some giant ass hippos.
Sir, the landing area is clear. What would you like to do? Drop the hippos. I would give anything to see that.
But you know what I mean? Like, I think that they're just a different species of the same planet. Like, Clover, I don't think is an intelligent species. Like, I don't think it's got destruction on its mind. It's just a destructor because of its size.
Now it's...
Like, if you dropped Clover into a giant, like, rainforest, he would just be, like, walking around and looking for something to eat. Like, he wouldn't be just like, must find humanity to smush. He just happened to be in Manhattan.
That's just where they drop him.
And they were shooting at him.
Now, here's the thing. I think that speaks perfectly to what Howard was saying.
What was Howard saying?
Howard, okay, so when they hear a sound and they think it's a helicopter, and he's like, yeah, but it's not ours. It's definitely not anything that we have. I think this is phase two. Because he's saying that
Clover was phase one.
Clover was phase one. You send it into your, like, highly populated cities, your metropolises. You take out as many people as you can. Big headquarters.
Yeah, you drop
right?
a bunch of hippos.
Yeah, you drop them hippos.
And then
they're
hungry. And then you go in and you shoot up everybody that's still remaining.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we are seeing in 10 Cloverfield Lane. It's phase two. It's the more intelligent people who are coming in after the dogs have sniffed everybody out.
And those dog things were the one we encountered in the car sequence.
I suppose that's true.
There is so much action in the final moments of this movie.
So much action.
Because she goes from like... The air is poisoned. The air's not poisoning. Oh, this dog. Gotta get keys. Go to this car. Go back to the truck. Go back to this car.
Go to the house. Shit. Aliens behind the house. Now, in that whole sequence, we go... I have no idea what time it is when she decides to break out. But I think Howard comes to get them in the middle of the night. Because it's, like, super dark. So I can only assume that it's the morning by the time she breaks out. No, in fact, he says he's making them dinner. Okay, so this makes a little more sense. Because I was going to say, by the time she breaks out, it gets dark fast.
Mm.
It's bright out. She hears birds. They're flying around. It's getting, like, dusk by the time the thing gets dropped in the corn. But as soon as she's hiding in the barn, it's, like, dark out. And it's probably just because, like, Batman rules. Aliens don't look cool during the day.
Yeah, also I think she'd be caught way faster if it was bright out.
And that fucking shot, right? Where, like, she's coming up to the house, but the alien ship's coming up from behind it.
Yeah.
And it's, like, super backlit.
Well, and then when
green mist
comes out. When the ship finally comes up, you see that this house is abandoned and all boarded up and, like, rickety.
Yeah, you just see the lights blaring through it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Pretty cool.
Totally worth it. Even if it's, like, timeline-wise, let's say it is actually morning and it should be bright out. So worth it for that scene.
Totally. Is there any other scenes that you wanted to talk about?
I will at least say, I still don't love the end of the movie.
You don't love it?
No, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just that the bunker stuff is too good. And the paranoia is so well done that once you find out that it's all real, it's not, I don't know, it just doesn't, it's not that it doesn't work for me, because it works, and it's great, and I think, like, a lot of other movies, indie movies, you would have come out and found out that there was no attack and it was just some weird thing. The fact that they're willing to go there and show you aliens and have, like, a full-on alien attack is great. Like, she has a fucking showdown with more than one of these aliens and she destroys them. It's awesome. I don't know. I don't love it. I'm talking about it now and it's like, man, sounds great.
I like it because it's... Even Howard's not right. Like, he thinks that there's been, like, some chemicals and there's nuclear fallout.
Unless
almost.
The Martians finally found a way to get to us. He's so certain that Martians exist.
But it's not even a nuclear fallout. It's almost like these ships are dropping quick-acting poison. Mm. Because as soon as the green is not on you, you're no longer poisonous. Because
only touched me a little bit. just a little bit.
But she takes the mask off, right after being submerged in that green nonsense, and it's not burning through her suit or anything.
Yeah. I think it's just as long as it gets her skin, maybe.
Yeah, I think
she probably
it's
has
just
to inhale it.
Poison.
Yeah.
But it's not a long-active chemical, which is interesting.
Yeah. What about you? Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No. I think I'm ready to rate the film.
Go for it.
I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 4.
I'm also giving it a 3.5 out of 4. I think every time I watch it, I like that ending more. Like, I've always thought that it worked. It just wasn't always my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just because the bunker stuff is so fucking good.
Yeah. And you know what? I do love the mystery solving, like, as much as I complain about it. It just keeps it from being, like, the perfect film because it feels just a little too set up and a little too screenwriterly orchestrated.
Sure.
But it is really fun to watch this character MacGyver her way out of every situation because you have somebody you really want to root for and she really earns her freedom.
Oh, yeah.
Not to say that, like, other characters, you have to earn your freedom to be in a horror film, but, like, you want to have somebody to cheer for, and from moment one, she is, like, fucking trying to get out.
Yeah,
and,
like, she doesn't just seize an opportunity at the end of the movie after an hour and a half of doing whatever this guy says because she's scared of him.
Mm-hmm.
She is always trying to find a way out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only because of that she's able to get out at the end when she can.
Totally.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy. But being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care. And BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Moving on, let's talk about Rob Reiner's Misery from 1990.
He almost died. You have a compound fracture of the tibia in both legs, and the fibula in the right leg is fractured too. And as soon as the roads open, I'll take you to a hospital. In the meantime, you've got a lot of recovering to do.
There is nothing to worry about. You're gonna be just fine. I'm your number one fan.
My name is Annie Wilkes.
Very kind.
The presumption must now be that Paul Sheldon is dead.
You dirty bird. How could you?
Misery Chastain cannot be dead.
Misery Spirit is still alive.
I don't want her spirit! I want her! And you murdered her!
You don't think he's dead, do you?
And don't even think about anybody coming for you, because I never called them. Nobody knows you're here. And you better hope nothing happens to me. Because if I die, you die.
Adapted from the Stephen King novel of the same name, Misery is currently sitting at a 7.8 out of 10 on IMDb, 89% on Rotten Tomatoes, 3 out of 4 from Roger Ebert himself, and 3.9 out of 5 on Letterboxd.
I think everyone always loves this movie.
Yeah.
It's especially this time of year, I find any time from Christmas on, it's on a lot of the Christmas watch lists. It's on a lot of winter watch lists, snow watch lists. And it makes a lot of sense because it's about isolation and being stuck indoors. It's a little bit cabin fevery, which is so funny because the day we're recording this, it is actually a snow day. We have taken a snow day. We're recording this way earlier than we normally do.
Oh, yeah.
We normally record at night. It's normally the most convenient time for us. And it's weird doing this in the day. Like, as I'm saying this, I'm looking out a window and it's just pure whiteness because it is, we're supposed to get 25 centimeters of snow today. So Misery was a perfect choice. It worked out really well for this week's episode.
If you're an American listener and you're familiar with inches, 25 centimeters is
like a foot and a half.
I was going to say just a lot. It's just a lot of snow. Yeah, this movie is perfect. This movie was always on TV for the longest time. Maybe it still is. I'm not sure. But back when I was watching TV all the time, this movie was on all the time.
Yeah.
And I think it's because you have performances from James Caan and Kathy Bates that are amazing. It's a Rob Reiner movie from a William Goldman script, and it's not incredibly violent.
Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty simple premise, and it's kind of a fun little thriller. Like, I think it's got a good audience.
Yeah.
It's more broad than, I would say, not most of Stephen King's stuff, but I think a housewife might be more interested in watching Misery than, say, The Shining or Cujo.
Yeah. I mean, one of the rare instances where there's almost no supernatural stuff.
That is also true.
That might also just be for the movie. I don't think I've read this book. But I'm going to go ahead and assume there's no supernatural stuff in the book, too. Mm.
Like, Misery comes back to defend.
She's haunted by the ghosts of the people she's killed. Mm. Like, I don't know, something like that, right? have no idea. Misery herself is a Wendigo. It just floats in on the wind.
Another fun fact about this movie, we actually watched our VHS copy of which we picked up at a thrift store not too long ago, which is kind of what sparked this episode initially. And the tape, I don't know if I've ever had this happen before, the tape was moldy.
Yeah.
Fucking moldy.
No, here's the thing. After watching it, I will agree with you. Very moldy.
It's pretty fucking moldy.
We should buy one of those tape cleaners for our VHS.
It was pretty great, though. I actually really enjoyed it. Such is the quality when you watch VHS. Sometimes you get some fuzzes and stuff. Our whole screen kept fuzzing out for periods, and it would be at the most great, like, the greatest moments. Kathy Bates would be like, misery.
Yeah. Don't ever leave. Like, it looked like a video artist had taken this movie and just, like, put a bunch of codecs on it and just, like, made the weirdest, most haunting art from the simplest scenes. But there were full sections of the movie that were fine to watch.
Yeah, and then there were times where the VCR player would just be like, no, it's not working, and turn off.
Yeah!
At like, one point, the whole VCR turned off.
It's like, yeah, we hit stop, and then the screen went black. Get it on DVD.
It took like
three... just spit it back out.
It took like 3 hours, but we made it through. We watched Misery. I hadn't seen the full movie in a really long time. Like you, I'd watched it in parts on television, so I don't know if I'd seen the entire movie from beginning to end before.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I hadn't sat down and watched the entire thing. And I think it's a small story, kind of the premise you understand, you get without having seen it. But the performances of the two characters and the ebb and flow of this captive and captor are such a good dynamic. It's a fun movie to watch.
Oh, a lot of fun. Especially knowing that, well, I mean, there are a lot of books by Stephen King where the main characters are definitely him, right? Like, he writes about writers and, like, cool, write what you know. Like, however the idea comes to you, just fucking go with it. But this one seems like almost the most personal, like the idea of, I'm your number one fan. I just love you so much. Like, what happens if that was a crazy person? You know what I mean?
And being like, what happened if your big ticket item, what brought you your success, was what brought you misery?
I'm so glad you said that. There are so many good lines,
like,
in this
ironies
movie.
Of the word misery itself.
I wrote almost every single one of them down.
Oh,
I think
great.
The one you're thinking of is, I haven't been a good writer since I got into the misery business.
Oh, so good. This movie should have been called Misery Business.
Oh, that would have been nice.
Or Misery's Business.
so many great uses of it where you're just twisting it. I love that we know that this character is somebody he absolutely hates. He's come to despise. He really loathes the fact that all he does is write these period piece romance type stories with this Misery character. So to find out that she has a pet pig named Misery is fucking great.
It's so funny.
It also comes at a point in the movie where she's picking up his new book. And one, he's sick of being there. He wants to get out. He still kind of believes her, like, oh, the roads are a little too messed up and I can't go to the hospital. But he's outstayed his want for a welcome by that point. He just wants to get out. And knowing that she's about to read his new book where he kills that character off for good, it's going to be rough roads ahead and he wants out of there fast.
Yeah, it's actually really great at the beginning because you always have this period in captive films where the captor is a little socially strange, as in our last film as well. But altogether, like, Annie's character in the beginning is, she's small town, but she's like humble and warm and welcoming. She says she's a nurse. She splinted his legs. She set him up all nice. They're in the middle of a blizzard. So, I mean, the situation at first, there's not really much cause for alarm or suspicion. And she's feeding him. She's taking care of him. She has medical grade painkillers.
Yeah, because she says she's a nurse. Yeah.
Yeah, he's set up pretty cushy. Like, until the roads get cleared, he's doing okay. He's going to live through this.
Have we taken the time to explain how he got there? In case, for anybody that hasn't seen the movie.
Oh, he just got in a car accident.
Yeah, he got into a car accident. She rescues him. Both his legs are broken. He can't go anywhere. And the roads, there's like a huge blizzard that blocked them all in that we keep talking about. And that's why he can't get to a hospital or back to his daughter.
And also the phones are down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if... If you're in a horror movie, there are no phones. And yeah. Everybody will tell you.
That remote cabin just like upstate New York was great when you were looking for a little retreat to write your novel. But oh boy, is it awful once you're secluded from the rest of the world.
And also the downside of the blizzard is that his car is entirely buried. So
the police don't have any idea where he is. As far as they know, he just disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yep. His credit card was last used at the inn he was staying at, and it hasn't been used since, and nobody's heard from him.
Yeah, he could be anywhere from there back to New York. Maybe he wants to disappear. They don't know. But there's a local sheriff who knows something's not right about this.
I feel like we're reading the back jacket.
Yeah, kind of. We're going to check in with that sheriff, though, with his super cute wife.
I know, their banter is great.
They're so great. They're driving down, and she puts her hand on his thigh. She's like, damn it, Martha. I don't remember her name, I'm sorry. But like, when you're in this car, you're not my wife, you're my deputy. I love it.
That's cute.
And she's always nipping at him that like his desk is a big, huge mess.
That's why you don't work with your spouse.
So Paul, James Caan's character, was on his way back to New York to deliver the manuscript for his new novel.
His first book.
Yeah, his first book after Misery. He's finally killed her off. He's getting back. He's writing something from the heart this time. Something about slum kids like himself, full of cock-a-doody language. Which, Misery. Nope, not Misery.
I want to call her Misery, too.
Constantly want to call her Misery. Everybody else in this movie, other than the two of them, is named Misery. We have a central character that we never see, a pig. They're all Misery.
That's it. The sheriff's named Misery.
The town.
A town called Misery sounds great.
Oh my god, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, foolishly, he lets her read that book. And she hates it.
She's so angry.
She's so
She shakes, she rattles the bed. His poor legs.
Doesn't she smack his legs at the same time,
too? I thought she just, like, she lifted the back legs of the bed and, like, slammed them down.
It's still rough. But because it's so full of filth, she makes him burn it.
Because he needs to free himself.
Yeah, he needs to get back. He's got to write more Misery novels. She thinks she's giving him a gift, right? Like, I'm going to release you from this. This awful burden that you've put on yourself.
At that point, has she read the ending yet, or she hasn't even gotten?
I don't think she's gotten to the end of it. Oh, you mean the ending of his new Misery novel?
Yeah.
I don't even know if she's picked it up by that point.
Oh, yeah, because she has him burn that manuscript pretty early on in the film, and that scene, I think I'm picking that scene as the scariest moment in the film. There's so many moments where she's eerie and creepy, but when she's doing that weird offhanded threatening where she's talking with her hands and splashing the lighter fluid on his duvet.
Yeah.
Because he's holding the matches at this point and he's refusing to light the manuscript, which she set up in a barbecue next to him. And she's slowly dousing him in lighter fluid as she's saying, like, you really need to do this, you need to do it for yourself, you need to do it, God wants you to do it, and like all this stuff, and nothing she's saying is outwardly threatening, but she's dousing him in lighter fluid.
Oh yeah,
that is so,
the choice is clear,
low-key menacing.
Yeah, she either burn the book or I'll burn you. That's what it comes down to.
What?
You want to die for your art? Because I'm also going to burn the book after I burn you as well.
So, and after this instance, so he does end up burning the book. It's really traumatizing for him.
Oh, man. James Caan plays it so well.
Yeah, because he tries to figure out. He's like, oh, my agent already has a copy. All the publishers have copies. And then she quotes something he said in an interview 11 years previous, saying like, oh, no, you're superstitious. You only have one copy. And she quotes what he says, like, verbatim.
Yeah.
Because she's his biggest fan.
There's something so interesting about this, too, because so she's going off about his habits and what he does, where he writes, how he writes. But at the beginning of the movie, we also see him finishing up that manuscript that he's going to deliver to his publisher. He's got a single cigarette, a single match, a bottle of Dom Perignon. How does she pronounce it?
Perignon.
Yeah.
Or Perignon.
Yeah, something like that. So Dom Perignon, as Annie Wilkes would say. So we know that he has habits, and very specific habits. And about halfway through the movie, she gifts him another single match to burn that manuscript. We also come back to that at the end of the movie as well. Like, it's just brilliant bookending for this movie. But I love how his habits are always used against him. Because it just goes to show that this is a turning point in his life. And if he can escape out of this, it's going to completely change who he is as a writer. He is in that transitional moment between the Paul Sheldon that he was. Yeah. because he's also putting misery behind him. He's trying to become somebody else. Mm-hmm. And like all of those habits and those comforts that he has, they need to go away in order for him to become a better person. It's interesting, too, because...
How metaphorical.
Well, yeah, Annie Wilkes also kind of represents the misery character. Like, it's interesting that she is his biggest fan and represents everything that he hates about misery. He has to kill misery in order to go on with his life, so he's got to kill her as well. Like, she's literally got him by the fucking coattails.
So after this point in the film, it's kind of like all pretenses are off. He stops asking when the roads are going to be plowed. There's kind of this weird unspoken... relationship between the two of them, where it's definitely understood that he is captive. And once Annie Wilkes reads the misery story and realizes that he has killed misery off, like, mm-hmm. all bets are fucking off. And she sets him up with a home office, and he is to rewrite misery and bring her back to life.
In her honor.
In her honor.
She's so delusional.
She is.
So delusional. Well,
in this point, you're like, oh, she wants to marry him.
Oh, yeah. There's even a moment later on where she says that, like, I was in love with Paul Sheldon, the writer, but now I know I'm in love with Paul Sheldon, the man. But I know that you don't love me. And, like, that's that moment in, like, where it's raining outside, right? Like, he's been there long enough that snow has turned to rain, and she sometimes gets a little blue.
Oh, my God, I forgot about this. So this is the creepiest scene. Like, yeah. Rain always makes me sad. And then all of a sudden she pulls a gun out.
Yeah, and she pulls the trigger. Like, she's just, like, she just wants to use it. Like, I have to go now.
And you know what she says? Like, I think about using this sometimes.
Oh, that's right.
And then it's, like, quiet for a minute or two, and then she's like, I have to go now.
I think I might load it. You're like, what? And then she just says, leaves.
Think,
she just drives off.
Put bullets in it.
Oh.
That is the creepiest thing a human being has ever said to another human being that has their legs in a brace, in a bed, in your house, as a stranger.
Yeah, you know, that familiar situation.
Everybody's been there.
They do a really good job of making him seem weak. Like, not pathetic.
Physically
yeah,
weak?
Yeah, physically weak. Because it's somewhere around there where she's left the house during the day. He sends her off to get new typewriting paper because his paper smudges. Yeah. She's not happy about that. But
she gets so mad.
But she drops a bobby pin. I think that's the real reason why he wants her to leave, just so he can get the bobby pin, because he's going to fashion it as a key to unlock the door so he can occasionally get out, maybe call the fucking cops. But even just that scene alone, like, that whole sequence is all about how hard it is for him to get around and how he can't escape, but we begin it with how hard it is for him to just pick up a fucking bobby pin. Like, the rest of it all plays out so perfectly because of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has to crawl around, and he can't reach a doorknob, he can't open the door, he's not in a position where he can steal a knife and fight back because he doesn't have the strength to do it. Oh, and by the way, when he finds the phone so he can maybe call for help, it's fake.
It's not even a real phone.
Yeah, like, he couldn't, it's not even that she unplugged it or cut the cord, it's just not real. Oh, man, it's nuts.
The interesting thing, too, about Paul Sheldon is that he kind of, once he understands he's in this situation, he, like Michelle in our last film, has a strategy kind of right away. Mm. And this is where the really interesting thing comes from these captor movies, because it all comes down to your characters. And for him, because he is without mobility and he doesn't have any strength and he's recovering, he is using manipulation and trying to understand who Annie is as a person to kind of use it against her. So he's often very sweet and sly with her, and he's got this kind of long con, and we gather that because he stops taking his pain medication,
mm-hmm.
and he starts hiding it in the mattress of his bed, which he's cut open, and we obviously you can kind of gather that he's going to try to poison her. And so he's really slowly working, almost like crafting a story,
yeah.
about this relationship blossoming, so that when he finally writes misery back into her story and she's been
reborn
to Annie's liking,
yeah.
they celebrate dinner together to celebrate misery's return,
yeah.
And
while she's out getting a candle so they can have a real candlelit dinner, he slips that whole packet into her drink. But Butterfingers here messes up, knocks over her cup, and spills the entire glass of red wine and all of the contents, like a month or two's worth of pain medication that would have at least knocked her out, right? Like his escape, he's just watching it flow onto the table and disappear.
And then, like from that moment on, the guise is completely dropped. Before he was like sweet as sugar to her, and like she would blow him a kiss, and he would catch it. And like there was just he was really feeding into this romance, this romantic delusion she had. And then afterwards, she's like waving at him outside, and he gives her the finger through the window. Like it's really great, the ebb and flow of how he's using his only resource, which is the relationship, to one, prevent her volatility, because whenever she's unhappy, she gets like crazy.
Oh yeah.
And to just to keep going another day so that he can hopefully get strong enough to get out of there.
And it's awful, too, because it's not awful, but it is kind of funny how much he hated writing the misery stories. And now he has to write the worst misery story ever just to satisfy the worst misery fan. Oh, man, it's nuts. Like, every horrible thing that could be written, she's like, oh, my God, this is so brilliant, and then there's this, and that
and
connection.
She's royalty! Yeah.
Just like every horrible decision you could possibly make to write into your character, he has to do it in order to please her. So it's just pulling teeth for him, right? But every page keeps him alive another day. So at this point, he's just writing to stay alive. And the worst part about that, too, is he's writing toward his own end. Because once the book's done, what's going to happen then, right? Mm-hmm. She's either going to kill him, or she's going to have no need for him anymore. Like, no matter what, things do not look good once it's over. And did you get the impression when the cop comes by that she was actually planning on selling that book?
I don't know. I think she's just trying to cover her ass. Like, I think she's just being overeager.
Yeah.
And she wants to show him that room before he discovers it.
Because
who knows? His name might have been on the top page.
That's a good point.
But yeah, so like meanwhile, while she's got Paul Sheldon and writing this book for her, the cop is getting closer and closer and closer. He's reading misery novels. He's flying around in the helicopter. They're trying to find the car. He knows something's up, even though everybody's kind of chalked Paul Sheldon up as dead.
Because yeah, they've found his car at this point, but they haven't found the body. He notices, though, that somebody used a crowbar to open the driver's side door, which means that he didn't get out by himself, which means he's probably, if not alive, dead. If not alive somewhere else, then dead, but not in the forest where they think he is. So he's staying on the case. And he comes across a very familiar line in one of Sheldon's books where Misery is going to court. And she says that, I answer to a justice higher than man. And I will answer only to him. And something about that strikes him, so he writes it down and he keeps it. And later on, when he's in the library, looking through old newspapers, he comes across a clipping of Annie Wilkes, who's been accused of murder, who said the exact same thing in court while defending herself.
Yeah.
This comes right after Paul also finds her fucking scrapbook.
Of murder.
Right? It's got photos of her pig in there, so it is still just like a regular scrapbook.
In and about, like, new child dead. There's photos of Misery the pig.
Yeah, but there's also like a newspaper clipping of her husband who fell to his death, which is unlike the divorce she explained.
Yeah, it's not what she said happened.
Also, top nurse of the school fell
dies.
To her death. Yeah, so she's just killing everybody ahead of her. She's killed a bunch of kids at the nursing home. She's killed elderly people at the nursing home. She has killed so many people.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to pose this question to you.
Yeah.
And I don't know what you're going to say.
Okay.
So, given that Paul Sheldon is a creature of habit and he always writes the same isolated cabin.
Yeah.
And that's the Wilkes farm, like the cop knows it's the Wilkes farm. Do you think that this has all been a long con for her to intercept him at some point in his life?
That's a great question, because she does say to him that she knows he writes at that hotel and would go to the hotel and park out front and just wonder what he was up to. So she's essentially stalking him already. I don't think it's...
Like, it just seems like an odd case of fate that she happens to be there to rescue him in this blizzard and she lives nearby.
Oh, I think it's... I don't think it's coincidental at all. I think she was following him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she was waiting for him to careen off the road so she could rescue him, but she definitely sees that opportunity as it came. I don't know that she ever follows him past the city limits. I think she just kind of like follows him while he's around town.
Mm.
And then when he's gone, his book shows up. So she's got that. She just reads it over and over and over and over again until he shows back up to write another book.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's very interesting.
Yeah. It would be maybe a little too convenient to find out that there were spikes in the road and that's why he fell off or something. Or she was out there with a hose just making it a little slippery.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past her character.
I wouldn't either. Because she seemed very ready to help him out of that car.
Yeah.
Who carries a gigantic crowbar with them?
Who carries a gigantic man on their back? I couldn't carry you if we were in a crazy accident. Like, I would probably, like, drag you a few feet and then give up and then maybe put you back in the car and be like, I'll go get help.
Yeah. I'll go find someone who can lift you.
Yeah, like, I'll look for a sled.
You know, obviously there are theatrical trailers that are leading up to this, and it's based on a novel that surely a bunch of people had read. But if you're going into this perfectly blind, I think that's part of why they shot it in the beginning, because you wouldn't assume that it's a woman who saves him.
Mm.
Like, you would just not think that initially.
And she's so, like, pleasant and sweet.
Yeah. Like, she's definitely lived on a farm her whole life, so she's...
She serves... his painkillers under a doily.
Under doilies, yeah.
That was a really great moment.
Oh, there was something I wanted to ask you, too, and I don't remember what it was.
We haven't talked about the hobbling scene. I think we really need to talk about that, otherwise people are going to be very mad at us.
Yeah. That's the scene everybody remembers in this movie.
Yeah, like, her holding the sledgehammer, like, if they make an action figure of her, if it didn't come with a sledgehammer, people would be angry.
Oh, I'd revolt.
I would be mad.
I'd be mad. I don't even care about action figures.
If it came with the pills and the doily, I would totally buy it.
I mean, that's a little different. Yeah, that'd be great.
Use a coaster.
Yeah, and James Caan's character just comes with, like,
Lifting the typewriter.
And I was going to say a barbell with two typewriters on either end.
And he's got like those long shorts that they wore in the 20s. You know, like the swimsuit shorts.
And then his opposable feature is him being able to do fisticuffs from inside his wheelchair.
Or pull a knife out of his sling.
Oh, yeah.
The fling slinger.
The fling slinger. Oh, man. I'm surprised he even went to sleep, period.
Oh my god. When she whaps his foot, you only see the one foot. It folds so realistically. Like, oh, it's I'm shuddering just like describing it.
Yeah. Oh man. By the way, this movie is directed by, I know I said it up top, Rob Reiner.
What has he done?
Rob Reiner did This Is Spinal Tap. He's done like some romantic comedy family-ish type stuff. You might recognize him as the dad in The Wolf on Wall Street. Pretty sure he directed Stand By Me, right? But more importantly, and you will recognize this, like, this guy's got, like, an insane career. You've definitely seen most of his movies. But I do actually think this would be a great double feature, also written by William Goldman, who adapted his own novel, The Princess Bride.
Oh, wow.
Can you imagine? Two movies where somebody is essentially bedridden, surrounding a story that they are creating and following all throughout. This is a great double feature with The Princess Bride. But yeah, your brother used to watch All in the Family a lot as a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was the son-in-law, the meathead. That's Rob Reiner. His dad's Carl Reiner, who was the writing partner with Mel Brooks.
So, like, comedy.
Yeah. Okay. This has been Hollywood Corner.
Thank you for that, John. I have another question for you.
Yeah.
This one I figured, because we're nearing the end of the episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who would you rather be stuck with? Annie Wilkes or Howard?
Man, that's tough. That is...
Not rather, but like, who would you... Of the two, you're going to be held captive. You get your choice of the two.
Yeah. That's really hard. You think you might have a chance with Annie Wilkes, because she seems to want to keep him around, except when she gets blue.
You got to play a more psychological game with Annie.
Much more psychological game with Annie. But here's the. Come back to that hobbling scene one more time. His legs are broken. He's broken both of his legs. They are finally starting to heal, and she fucking breaks him again. Oh, I can't get over that. It makes me hurt. It makes me hurt so very much. But Howard
comes with aliens. So
he definitely comes with aliens, but he also comes with just like snap decision
and acid. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, at least with Annie, like, there is a real world that exists outside that you could hopefully get to. I guess now that we know there's no phone, there's no fucking chance. Like, you are against Annie no matter what. If I had to choose somebody to fight, I'd probably rather choose Annie.
Yeah, I guess I'd rather fight Annie. Like, if it came to a showdown.
Yeah. Howard just seems way too prepared. Annie is, it's a crime of passion. You know, like it's planned out. What am I fucking talking about? She's killed dozens of people. She's killed so many fucking people.
Yeah, I mean, Howard, you could probably run away from, but you'd have to be running around a table because there's not much room in the bunker to run.
Howard could throw that body weight too, right? There's no stopping Howard.
He could throw a jukebox.
He's a military man.
That's true. He probably knows how to shape, though.
You see how many fizzy pops he's drinking at dinner? That's his first
problem. But then there's also aliens, so like it's...
Yeah. What do you escape into? A world where you still have to fight.
Yeah, so it's like this captor and then broken legs, or this captor and then aliens after.
I mean...
And potential acid. Like, death means acid.
Broken legs, though. Broken legs. Ugh, I got a bad ankle and I twist it all the time, and it's nothing close to breaking it. I don't want to break it.
Both of them.
Really? Yeah, bro, both of them! Yeah! So Annie. Yeah, Annie, I guess. Oh, that is a horrible decision to make.
I'd like to see a parody of this done with J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter.
That's interesting.
Like a crazy Harry Potter fan.
That sounds great. This movie will... Do you think this movie's going to be remade soon?
I don't think so.
Eventually everything's going to be remade, right?
I don't think this one is. Unless, who's it that does all the Stephen King movies for Netflix?
Oh, Mike Flanagan?
If he wants to. I don't think Mike... they will.
Yeah, right? If he says so.
If he's like, you know what? I still have the bed from Gerald's Game. Let's...
his next one could have been Dolores Claiborne, maybe. Because Dolores Claiborne and Gerald's Game are like mirrors of each other in some degree.
He's doing Dr. Sleep, right? Is he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Mike Flanagan wouldn't touch a property that's already been adapted. Because he probably has too much respect for it.
Like House on Haunted Hill?
I mean, like a Stephen King property.
Or the Haunting of Hill House?
A Stephen King property that's already been adapted.
Okay, we haven't done ratings. So what is your rating of Misery?
I want to give it a higher rating, but I'm giving it a 3 out of 4.
I'm also a 3 out of 4.
That final showdown, right? It's so earned, where he just like smashes her over the head with the typewriter. And it's so bloody. And he is he's really up against the wall on this one. Because he can barely fight.
And it's also the very end of the rope. Like, she's already killed the police officer, and she's coming in to kill him, and there's no more time left. No matter, there's no bargaining chip, there's no convincing her, there's no warming her over. Like, she is convinced, and it's happening. So, like, even if he's not at his peak strength or not ready, he just has to go for it.
But he still uses his charm to buy himself another day, like another few hours where he can write the rest of the book, they can bring Misery out into the world, and then they can murder suicide each other, right? But again, like his habits, we've got a single cigarette, a single match, some champagne, but he finally gets to burn a book he wants to burn, and it's so that way she gets on the floor where he can bash her. Like, oh, it's a great ending.
Mm-hmm.
It is such a vicious, bloody fight, and it's so worth it.
Totally.
And, you know, unlike most Stephen King stories and most Stephen King adaptations, it ends in such a brilliant way, where he's staring at the waitress who's coming to him, who he sees as Annie Wilkes, and he's like, I don't think I'm ever going to get over that. I'm always going to see her everywhere I look. And then we see that it's just a regular person asking if he wants a piece of cake. But no, she comes to say that she's his number one fan. He goes, that's very nice of you. Credits. Oh.
PTSD.
Right? So well done. And like the look on his face is great too, because he knows it's not real, but it still scares him. But he's still...
It's something that's going to be with him forever.
Like, exactly.
This is what he's got to deal with now.
Yeah.
Anytime a fan says that to him, which might be every time he's in public.
Mm-hmm. But he stopped caring about what other people think. He's not writing for his fans. He's not writing for critics. He's writing for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Writing for the fans is what got him into this mess, kind of. And it finally doesn't matter. He's writing something for himself.
Oh.
Which is hilarious because to escape, he had to write for Annie, for his audience. So it's a fucking good movie. Oh, I want to give it a higher than 3.5 out of 4, but it's like, it doesn't have a lot to it.
That's the thing, is it's just a simple story. Like, it's really well done and the characters are great, but you could write the synopsis in a sentence or two. So it's just really confined. So there's only so much it can do. Maybe some ghosts next time. No, I'm kidding. Maybe. I don't want ghosts.
Ghosts would be okay.
But we want to hear what you thought of both of these films. So tweet at us at NOFS Podcast. You can find us on Facebook in our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/horrorfiendsofNOFS. We also have an official subreddit. If you haven't checked that out, we share photos, memes, articles, that kind of stuff there. That is reddit.com/r/nightmareonfilmstreet.
And of course, if you could leave a 5-star rating and review of the podcast wherever you're hearing it, it would help get the show in front of more fiends and grow the horde.
We are controlling transmission.
Yee-hoo! Have a trouble with 11?
Nightmare on Film Street is brought to you by Baphomet & Co. Small batch soap inspired by horror and the macabre. This week's pick is the Mary Brown Bar. An elusive soap that is as black as they come. Intoxicating deep wood, sharp and confronting. Inspired by the 1999 film The Blair Witch Project by Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez. Memories of an endlessly confounding wood doubling back on itself. An evasive trickster who is perhaps not a trickster at all, conjuring up something awful under the cover of nightfall. Get 10% off your order with the code NIGHTMARE at BaphometandCo.com. That's 10% off with the code NIGHTMARE. Baphomet & Co. Made by hands, sometimes severed. Want to reach the cool creeps? Advertise with Nightmare on Film Street to get your brand out of the shadows. For more information, head to nofspodcast.com/advertise. This show is edited, improvised, and
tweeted.
Researched. Yeah, it's mostly just tweeted and talked about by Kim and myself, but it is listener supported. Head over to patreon.com/nightmareonfilmstreet to find out about all of the cool extra bonus content, hours of bonus episodes available to you as a supporter of the show for as little as a coffee a month.
Yeah, and we are also uploading, right as we speak, a bonus episode for our Patreon supporters. Continuing the conversation on this week's episode, we're going to play a little game that John's put together that I'm going to do horribly well at.
I'm calling it, Oh Captor, My Captor.
And you can download that at patreon.com/nightmareonfilmstreet.
Yeah, we're going to see how good Kim remembers some other captive captor movies. And
spoiler alert, I don't know any of them.
That's okay. Well, it's multiple choice. You'll do just fine.
But that's it from us this week. We'll be back at you again in 2 Thursdays from now. I'm Kim.
I'm John.
Stay creepy.
It appears you made it out alive. Just long enough to tell the tale of the Nightmare on Film Street. Ow! Help us grow the horde. Leave a review on iTunes or wherever you subscribe. Continue this week's conversation on Twitter by following at NOFS Podcast. And as always, more terror can be found lurking on our website, www.nightmareonfilmstreetpodcast.com. Until next week, stay creepy, fiends.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.